It's 8:14. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Summit County Council meeting yesterday and spending a couple hours talking about the Canyon Corners project, the new home for Whole Foods Market. On the phone to update us on that, I have Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Leslie.
So after considerable discussion, the council went ahead and approved the project. This is, again, two buildings, including the 43,000-square-foot Whole Foods Market. A lot of discussion taking place against mitigating traffic impacts. You asked the developers a lot of questions about a roundabout and if it would work. In the end, you joke that you drank the Kool-Aid, as you put it, but felt that they offered some compelling reasons against a roundabout. What were those?
Well, the biggest kind of deal breaker for me on the roundabout was the fact that they would lose 43 parking stalls, and that the project would, you know, have to cut down by 60% the affordable housing and the building B. I mean, there were a lot of our engineering and staff and public works were saying that the intersection would not fail and that it was fine as it was. The grades were difficult there. There was an asphalt standard that it needed to be no steeper than 4% in the roundabout itself, which meant that you had to chase grade and steepen it up coming in and coming out of the roundabout, and it had a huge footprint. And, of course, it was going to be very expensive. Those things weren't as compelling, but when we – basically, the compromise was that if it fails, we have the right as the highway authority and memorialized in the development agreement to eliminate the left turning movements in and out of that project, which means that it's right turn only, and that's the only tool left in the toolbox. And it just became readily apparent that this project wouldn't work with a roundabout without major redesign and a lot more expense. And so the compromise is that we can take away their make it right turn in and out only, and we'll only do that if it's warranted. But
so
it's difficult. I mean, I wish in the ideal world I would put a roundabout there personally.
So who decides if those left-hand turns have to go? The county council, the county engineer?
County engineer.
Okay. What's the condition that within 5 years after the project's built that the county can conduct a traffic study at the developer's expense to gauge the traffic impacts?
I don't think we left that in there. I think what's going to be in the agreement now, and we approved it subject to review of the chair, but I think what it is within 5 years, the county engineer can determine that the left turning movements need to go away, in which case the developer has to pay to basically make it right in, right out only. That after 5 years, we would pay for it.
So another condition sounded like the applicant would have to support a bike sharing program. What's that?
Well, they're going to buy 24 bicycles that would, they'd have three locations, one at their project and two at yet to be determined ones around the basin, and that you could hop on a bike and basically rent it and ride to their facility or back to one of the other two locations. We've wanted that. Our staff has wanted to try that. It's taken off in other communities, and so there'll be a 5-year period during which time they will maintain those bikes, buy them, and operate them, and see if it catches on.
So, would one of those locations be the new transit center?
Could be. I mean, we'll want to strategically figure out where those are. And, of course, if it's not on county-owned property, we'd have to have the consent of the business.
Now, is there a safe walkway or bikeway from the transit center to this parcel?
I believe there is. I think there's one on the south side of the road. There's a path, but I can't tell you for sure.
And do the bikes have to have baskets?
Leslie, we didn't get to that level of detail. I would think they would.
All right. The second building in the project has retail and affordable housing on the upper level. So when is the developer required to build that affordable housing?
Well, that was another one of the concessions we required. We have language in the development agreement now that says that they will not be able to get a certificate of occupancy on the Whole Foods building unless they have commenced construction on and achieved the four-way inspection on the affordable units, all of them. The four-way inspection is when the building is up, the shell is built, and they've done the electrical and plumbing and HVAC, and they call for an inspection before it's drywalled. And so at that point, they said that they want to start both the Whole Foods and the other building simultaneously, but they think the finishes in the affordable units will take 6 months longer than it will to bring the other on. So rather than hold up the Whole Foods by a full 6 months, we compromised and said that they would have to be at this four-way inspection point before they could get occupancy. So, you know, they don't get anything unless they get to the four-way.
All right. Now, the Whole Foods folks are, well, they have announced that they plan to have a tap room selling local beer and wine on tap. Does that require county approval?
I mean, obviously, we've approved the development agreement, and it has that element. I don't know what happens from here, whether they'll need a business license. I don't know whether they'll need a liquor license or something. I don't know exactly what, on that specific, what's required beyond what we've done.
And there was also a question about what would happen if Whole Foods were to leave the building. What other uses would be allowed? Did you get to that?
There's an exhibit to the agreement that is permitted and conditional uses, and it has a list of similar uses. I don't have it in front of me, but we're comfortable that the agreement will transcend Whole Foods.
All right. We mentioned the transit center briefly. This was kind of put on hold to give the new transportation director a chance to look at it. Where do we stand with getting that built?
I don't think that we have selected a contractor yet. I think we're still working through some design issues. The staff hasn't brought it back to us for an update. I thought ground would have been broken prior to now, but I think it's imminent, but it's taking a little longer.
All right. What did the council decide on the appeal from StayParkCity.com for their wall-mounted sign on the Park City Tech building?
We granted the appeal, so that our thinking was that the owner of that second floor, which is a subsidiary of All Seasons, and they have a sister company that's just State Park City that has common ownership. And All Resorts itself occupies, or All Seasons occupies, about 4,200 square feet of that building, and the same employees, same officers, same accountants, the same people run State Park City. And so we deemed that for those reasons, that they fit under the guidelines, and it was a split vote. Roger voted no. Claudia had accused herself and had a prior commitment, but we approved it on a 3-1 vote.
All right. What has the council heard about the Boyer Tech Center and that second building?
Well, on city tour, Roger and Claudia and Kim attended and the public announcement of Skullcandy's going into the second building. And I don't know what the staff has heard. I just know that they've made a deal, but we the council have not been briefed on what's happening other than the good news that Skullcandy is staying and will be a tenant there.
Yeah, so you're not aware of any requested changes then from the Boyer Company as part of the development approval?
No. I mean, there was talk last night that we should consider cleaning up some of the language in the sign section of the development agreement, which would require an amendment, and we been down that road before, and amending that agreement is not an easy task, and it should happen someday, at least on this, to clean up this sign language, but that's not going to happen for State Park City, and when it happens, we don't know.
All right. Anything else, any interesting public comment or anything at yesterday's meeting?
No. I mean, we had our hands full with Corner Canyon, and we hope that that's going to be successful, but we are concerned that we're going to have problems on that, on Landmark. But we would have problems, perhaps more problems, if they developed as they were allowed to before. So we hope this whole food and the affordable housing and the other community benefits make it worthwhile.
Okay. Real quick, you were a member of the annual road tour. Any impressions from you? Any thoughts about the affordable housing issues, traffic, relations with Vail?
I thought it was, I've been on three city tours now, and I thought it was probably the best one that I've been on for this reason, that Breckenridge is most similar to Park City, especially given the fact that we are communities that have existed before Vail, and that we both have Vail as major components to the community. I think the takeaway regarding Vail is that they're a very strategic and successful business, and that they can be great partners, but they also are very strategic, and that we need to make sure that we're at the top of our game, and that we meet like with like in terms of collaborating. We have a great opportunity to collaborate, but they're sophisticated, you know, not adversary, but partner, and we need to be up to it. I thought that they, Breckenridge and the communities we visited had really done great things with taking care of their workers, not just in housing, but also in child care. And I thought there were a lot of good takeaways from that. We're going to have a debrief at the council next week, and hopefully we can get Miles to join us, similar to what is likely to happen tonight at City Council.
Okay. Hey, Chris, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
That's Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. It's 8:29 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, it's been nearly 9 months since Robert Hilder took office as Summit County Attorney. Take a look at his first several months in office. We invited him in. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning, Leslie. A pleasure.
Well, you served for years as a judge in 3rd District Court, and I noticed Rick Bruff continues to refer you to you as Judge Hilder. So once a judge, always a judge, or no?
Well, yes and no. I retired. I guess I'm entitled to be called that. But I think it sort of gets in the way of what I'm doing now. So I tell everybody, call me anything you like except Bob. I don't mind Bob, but it ain't me. So Robert, typically.
Okay. Well, so from the outside, at least from my perspective, doesn't seem to be a lot of change in the county attorney's office. Has there been?
No, there really hasn't been. Certainly no change in the personnel. We are very, very fortunate in the quality of the people we have there. It's been an incremental thing, and I'm not there to deal with any significant big issues. But also, frankly, I think it took at least 6 months to start to get some confidence of, particularly on the civil side of the council, to get to know my deputy prosecutors. There's four of those. But we're doing some things differently, and some of them lead to a little bit of disagreement. But as far as I can tell, they tell me when they disagree, we work it out, and if I need to, I make a decision. But we've had a few things.
Yeah. So what do you think you've done for county residents that maybe the former attorney did not?
Well, you can never be sure, but I'm definitely very involved on both sides. And I think David was primarily a prosecutor and a good one. But I am, it's roughly equal. I'm in Colville 2 to 3 days a week. I'm in Silver Summit the other days. I'm doing a half load of adult prosecution. But I've taken actual assignments in the civil area, quite a few, in fact. I'm also actively working as counsel to the county council, but I would be blind if I didn't understand that the county council has had a wonderful lawyer in Dave Thomas with his abilities for years and supported by Jamie Bracken and Helen Strawn. And it's taken a while, I think, for the council to say, yeah, maybe we can rely on this guy. But mostly we're trying to complement each other, and I think we're doing it well.
So you're not taking cases just on the civil side, no?
No, I'm doing the criminal cases, and I'm doing civil, not just cases. So much of it is advising, drafting documents, which primarily I leave to the three regulars because they have vast experience in that. But I review anything significant that goes out. We work cooperatively. We meet frequently. I think we're just working as a team. I really believe that. You should bring them in and ask.
So have you identified any goals that you'd like to see over the next several years?
Well, on one side, which is sort of a crossover between criminal and civil, is the whole area of environmental crimes. That's one that's just getting legs in the state generally. Salt Lake County, Sim Gill are leading the way on that. But one thing I've learned very quickly, although I think I knew it, I now understand the commitment. We have a council that's very committed to quality of life issues, environment, transportation, homeless housing, which is one of the areas I've taken on is affordable housing. But I'm also learning how many things we need to do in environmental areas that, frankly, across the state, we don't always get. There are crimes, and they're an enforcement mechanism. But I think a very common refrain throughout our county, whether it's building, code enforcement, criminal side, we use those to make sure that the things are done right. We don't use it to punish. Environmental crimes are very underused, but we don't realize what we're doing when we dump a barrel of oil or when we, well, there's numerous things. That's the thing. I'm going to take a course on that in the next couple of weeks. But I think we need to use that, but not to punish, which, frankly, I think you also see on the criminal side. Some of our disagreements, not big ones, have been, well, I don't really want to say it, but the Emil Hirsch case was one that was prominent. But that's just a high-profile example of things we do. Yeah,
I want to get back to the email, but let me just ask you this. So with budget time coming up, I mean, what will you be requesting from council? Do you need more staff?
We've already requested. A very critical area is still the Children's Justice Center, which was started under my predecessor, but it has a very strong director in Melissa and incredible support from our investigator, Christina Sally. And in that area, Melissa is not full-time. We've requested to move her to full-time, to free up Christina for some other work, but also to get some support from other areas. But we've got to boost that, and we need to get a building, a place for them to work. It may not be a building. It may be part of one. They're working out of the basement of the Richens building right now, very small quarters. That probably is our biggest budget request. We've tried to keep it minimal. I am not looking for new attorneys. I think it's my job to pick up any slack, and so far we seem to be working well. I don't think we need them for at least a year. So we did ask for a little bit more training money in the domestic violence. I don't think that's probably going to go through, but excuse me, but there is some money for that. But we're not asking for much new.
All right. Well, here's one of my kind of, I don't know that it's a pet peeve, but it's just something that's difficult in the attorney's office, and that is access to lawsuits. I mean, the way I understand it, you either have to pay to get into the state court system through PACER or something, or, you know, we send out a reporter a couple times a week, another car on the road driving back and forth, pay 10 cents a page to make copies of any court documents he thinks are relevant. Mm-hmm. I mean, why can't we just go on, you know, and we do everything else online? Why can't we do that?
Well, to get into the full database, it's through the administrative office of the courts, and I think when you say you have to pay, that's the exchange system. It's not that expensive, I don't think. And certainly the benefit there is you can get in, you can view, and you can print. I was not aware that was, I mean, I worry about the copy cost, but we're going as paper-free as we can. I'd like to explore a way we could make that happen. I'm certainly willing to open up anything to you, but you're talking about more widely. Can we see what's happening day to day? And that is problematic. So I don't know. It used to be about $35 a month. Do they make it more for the press because we don't like you? Or
I don't know. Probably.
Let's find out that number and see if we can help you on that.
But even so, I mean, just to be able to bring in a thumb drive, you know, so that we can just bring it back, not have it to print paper, right?
We're in a constant problem with that technology. We're in a conference this week in Park City with statewide prosecutors, and it turns out that with so much electronic filing, some things are working like that and some just aren't working. But we're trying to fix that. But I'm not sure we could make that work even if we wanted to. But we should be able to get around the cost if we can do it electronically. And I'm happy to jump in. You should have called.
Well, it's easier here. Yeah. Hey, the most certainly the most high-profile case that you've dealt with this year has been, of course, the Emil Hirsch sentencing. He was sentenced to 15 days in jail last month. Serve that time. Mm-hmm. Any incidents you can report on? Or
no, none at all. In fact, that there was disagreement in the office. A deputy was handling it. I ultimately handled it at the end. There was no significant difference of opinion on how long he should serve. There was on how long his plea in abeyance should continue. That's an area to me. Mr. Hirsch, I'm sorry he's high profile. I didn't know who he was, but I learned. But he behaved very well after the initial misbehavior, which was egregious. He dealt with the drug and alcohol issues, whatever they were. He did inpatient treatment. He came and met, he and his father and his lawyer, with me and my deputy. And you say sentenced. We actually gave him a plea that's not a conviction, and he agreed to go to jail, which we could not have enforced on a plea in abeyance, but that was the deal. My deputies thought that I should expect a year, year and a half on the plea in abeyance. The reason I didn't was classic, but I did it a week before with somebody else who has no profile. It's often about employment. It's about the ability to make a living. Now, Mr. Hirsch apparently makes a very good living. But if he'd had a conviction, or if the plea in abeyance had continued for any substantial time, he essentially couldn't enter many, many countries where his work is done. And we looked into that. We actually dealt with Toronto attorneys. We looked at what would structure ability for this man to go forward, given that he has in fact, taken responsibility. He also paid a fine in the $5,000 range, I think it was. His community service, I'm not up to date, except that I have to approve what he does. And he is going to do it somewhere else. I asked him face-to-face to make it meaningful and use his abilities and his profile to do something worthwhile. But I'll be glad to report back, because he will not be off the plea in abeyance until it's done.
Okay, that plea in abeyance, you sentenced for how long as opposed to the 1.5?
It's only 90 days. It's all about travel, and it's about being able to expunge, which, as I say, I did two or three plea in abeyances in the Justice Court on Tuesday. We do them all the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's your philosophy about approaching this? I mean, this, of course, a high-profile tabloid case. I mean, if a poor Hispanic man did the same thing to a white professional woman, would the result have been the same?
With me, it probably might get up a little better. He certainly wouldn't pay the fine. Now, understand, in violence, this was not domestic violence, although I don't, as a father of daughter, granddaughter, any violence against women is outrageous. But there is a difference. This was drunken, crazy behavior. If someone did something similar, the amazing thing is, Leslie, it's not at all a given that they go to jail. They simply do not. Or they go for a very short time, shorter than 15 days. But what we do always try to address is a treatment issue. The counseling, the education. I spent a year as a dedicated solely domestic violence judge in the late 90s in Salt Lake. A lot of best practices there, but it's really hard to know what will work. But as far as the Hispanic man, or I don't care what race it is, I'd care about getting them into something to try and prevent the behavior. And I would not for a moment tell you it always works.
All right. Kentucky court clerk went back to work this week, that after being jailed for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And I just want to be very clear that our court clerk here, Kent Jones, has been more than accommodating in this. So I just want to make sure that that's not. But if the fact that we had a Kim Davis here, I mean, would you have done the same as what we saw back there in Kentucky if our clerk had refused to issue licenses?
If I was a judge, the attorney, I would say, number one, her conduct was shameful. It was mostly shameful. It's shameful because of how she treats people who are not like her. She has her religious liberties. That's fine. But you choose to be an elected official. You make a real effort to do that. You take the salary. You take the honor that comes with some of these positions. You do the job. I would have, as a judge, certainly done something like jail her for contempt until she dealt with it. I'm not sure she would have been out in a week, because she didn't really accept that she had an obligation to do this. And then she says, they're not okay because my name's not on the certificate. If in Utah, one, Kent's a wonderful man. Two, we do require, in fact, the religious freedom, I trouble with the name, but Stuart McAdams' bill was really quite well done. It ain't perfect, none will be because of the tensions, but that bill requires under a number of laws that were amended through the senator's legislation, the county clerk must establish policies to issue licenses and solemnize marriages. That really means he can do it through deputies if he personally has a concern, but if all the deputies say, sorry, Kent, don't want to do it, Kent's got to do it. It's not like we've even had a ripple of concern, as you say. Now, the problem is in Utah, if someone doesn't want to, there are ways to remove a public officer. I've dealt with it as a judge, not as a lawyer, but it is very difficult. We are one of about 13 states that does not have a recall election provision. County officers are not subject to impeachment, but there is a statutory means. But it's very cumbersome, rarely effective.
So is that what we need to do, go back and amend the McAdams bill then to make that?
Well, there may be other issues in the future, but as far as the obligations on the clerk, it is just fine. The question is, if a county clerk refuses to do it and refuses to quit, which is the honorable thing to do, then we have to maybe find a better way than our current statute to remove an officer, because it's even questionable whether it's malfeasance, which is required. It's not a high crime or misdemeanor, probably. That's one basis. Malfeasance is another. We have very little case law on that. There is part that says that the actions are unethical and against standards of morality and, oh, I think it's something like that, honesty. I think you're not honest if you take an oath. I would run a lawsuit on that, and it's a county attorney's responsibility ultimately to make that happen. I would run that if someone didn't do their job, but I'm not at all sure it would succeed.
Okay. I need to leave it at that. Anything else you'd like to say?
No, it's been a pleasure working in the county. I think I don't want it to be too obvious what changes come, because I don't think they need to be that substantial. But I do think we need to keep working, and I'm very grateful for the chance to do this.
All right. Summit County Attorney Robert Hilder, thanks.
Thanks.
It's 8:44 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Park City High School Boosters Club has big plans for this year. In the studio, I have the president of the Booster Club, Kayla Pellegrin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what do you hope to accomplish this year?
You know, we are, first and foremost, we're just trying to get the word out. A lot of people that we've talked to are not aware that there is a Park City High School Booster Club. Those that are aware, I think, have the misinterpretation that we represent just sports or maybe just one or two sports. And as of about a year ago, we transitioned to our booster club so that we're part of the athletic department. All of our fundraising goes to the benefit of all of our extracurricular activities. So that extends beyond just football and baseball and basketball, the traditional sports, and it also helps support a lot of the other sports that we have, girls soccer, boys soccer, wrestling, track and field, cross country. But in addition to that, we also support our performing arts, band, drama, even the debate team is another group that we work with.
So besides fundraising, how does the Booster Club help out those organizations, those groups?
So we have several different opportunities. We look for fundraising opportunities to work with the teams. We've tried to consolidate a lot of our fundraising opportunities through concessions. So instead of concessions, as an example, benefiting just one or two teams, we actually have opportunities for each of the teams to staff it so that they can fundraise. The other opportunity is through Booster Club sponsorships, corporate sponsorships with our advertising at Dozier Field, at the gym, as well as at the baseball and the softball field. So any business can advertise, the funds that we advertise through those banners and through our advertising and announcements actually goes to the benefit of all the teams. We have five different scholarships that we offer students, graduating seniors at the end of the year, and we also have many grants that we've given to each of the different teams and activities within our organization.
Yeah. So, I mean, the most popular sports, football and soccer, I mean, are they the best funded?
They are, you know, I can't speak to the funding, and unfortunately Jamie Sheets wasn't here to join us today. What I can say is the teams that have a harder time raising money on their own, come to the Booster Club, and we actually offer them grants to help them with their funding. A lot of the fundraising in the past has really been put on the shoulders of the students and the student athletes, the students participating in the extracurricular activities, and their parents to try to go through some of their individual fundraising. As a part of this program, we're really trying to centralize a lot of that fundraising so that we have a greater deal of equity and reducing the burden on our students.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if, you know, members of the dance club can staff the football concession stand, because that's where a lot of the money is made, you know, not during the dance performance.
Absolutely. In fact, this year, during our football games, we've already had track and cross-country staff concessions. We also have boys soccer and wrestling will be staffing it later in the year. Debate also previously staffed it earlier in the year. So it gives us a lot of opportunity, and that's been at the baseball games and other events that we have, and we hope to extend that into basketball and baseball as well.
All right. So, like, do you help the lacrosse teams? I mean, they are not sanctioned by the UHSAA.
There are some limitations due to Utah state laws around financing and the sharing of public and private funds, but we do work with those teams to find opportunities. We are hoping and expecting that lacrosse be sanctioned in the year of 2017, or at least that's our hope. So we are absolutely looking for parents to become involved, especially parents that have an interest in lacrosse. Everything that we do today is really going to mostly benefit our students further down the road. But we do try to find opportunities to work with those teams whenever we can.
All right. So you're asking people to join you, help out, huh?
Absolutely. There's many different ways that the people can become involved in Booster Club. We're looking for volunteers to help with different committees that we've created. We have business sponsorships, and there's different levels. So any of the local businesses, we have, you know, different programs that they can become more involved in, and things that we can work with their budgets that can stay within their budgets. And then also for individuals of the community, we've got Booster Club memberships and an all sports pass that anyone can join. You don't have to be a parent of a high school student, but if you have an interest in attending any of our games, we have an all sports pass that's $150 for a family, and they can attend all of our regular games, whether it's football or baseball or basketball, any game where we charge, any regular games where they charge admission, the sports pass will actually get you admission to the events.
Okay, now that's good for the family then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. And again, the sponsorship packages range from $500 to $4,000, again, for the businesses.
Correct. So we've got five different levels that, as you mentioned, are from $500 to $4,000. So local businesses that want to support us, it's a great way to become involved in the community. And we know that in looking at other communities, it really comes down to the support of the community and coming together. So we've got different packages that can meet your budget.
All right. So you meet every Wednesday, the first Wednesday of each month, 6 o'clock at the high school?
Yes.
People are welcome to join?
It is open to the public. People are welcome to join. And in fact, we encourage people. Our attendance has actually tripled in the last 2 months, which is great. Starting out with four people last year, we're actually up to about 20, 25 people attending the meetings today. And we'd really like to double that this year and possibly double that again next year.
All right. People can send you an email if they're interested.
Absolutely. There's a couple different ways they can contact us. We have an email that goes directly to the Booster Club, which is boosterclub@pcschools.us. And then also the new athletic website that was launched earlier this summer is parkcityminors.us. We have a Booster Club page that's available and has a lot of the information there as well.
Great. Kayla, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
It's Kayla Pellegrin. Again, she's the president of the Park City High School Boosters Club. It's 8:52 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, once again, Rocky Mountain Power proposing a surcharge on those who have installed solar panels on their homes and businesses, saying that with the reduction in what they're paying to the utility company, solar users are now no longer paying their fair share. Park City resident David Bennett says nonsense. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So it was about a year ago when Rocky Mountain Power first requested the Public Service Commission to rule on that their request to impose a fee on those using solar panels. What we saw was, I mean, it was ultimately denied, but a state law then was passed last January, which basically directs that a cost-benefit analysis be done to better analyze the situation. Are you aware of where we are in that process?
Well, we're set with a public hearing in front of the Public Service Commission on the 8th of October at 5 p.m. And at that time, they will take public testimony as to the pros and cons of imposing either a specific monthly user fee or really what we fear is that they're going to go to an entirely different rate structure for those of us that have solar panels.
Would you be grandfathered or you don't know that yet?
Don't know that yet, and I think they're going to do everything. What this is all about, Leslie, is that Rocky Mountain Power is invested in burning coal. They own the coal plants. 61% of the power in the state of Utah comes from burning coal, and they want to continue it. And they want to nip this movement of rooftop solar in the bud. They do not like what they don't like individuals having rooftop solar, and this is their second attempt at both trying to penalize us, but also to send a message to individuals who are thinking about rooftop solar not to do it.
Yeah. Well, what they say is that residential solar power generation has become so widespread that customers are unfairly offloading their share of maintaining the power grid. So most solar users still need to be part of that grid. So isn't that a fair request?
It is not. They have created this as their justification for trying to stifle the use of solar. And when you take a look at the benefits, when you take a look at those of us that are, there's about 3,000 of us now with rooftop solar, and the fact that we're able to minimize the burning of coal, the spending of new power plants because of what we're doing, at the end of the day, it all balances out. But let's jump up a little bit higher. In April, Park City Film Series showed the movie The Merchants of Doubt. And following that movie, your colleague Lynn Ware Peake moderated an excellent panel discussion. There is no doubt, none whatsoever. Climate change is very real. It's very real upon us. And as a society, we need to move in the direction of using renewable solar. We need to get away from these petty kind of arguments as to whether or not we are misusing the grid and get to what is much more important is the future of this planet. It may be too late already. We hope not. But we need to move, and we need to stop the utilities, Berkshire Hathaway's attempt nationwide through their power companies to squash the use of rooftop solar. We need to be doing just the opposite. We need to be promoting individuals using renewable energy.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking about maybe a $5 a month surcharge. That's not much.
It is not much. Last year, it was a $4.95 proposal. We don't know what they're going to do this year. They haven't said. It may be that surcharge. It also may be an entirely different rate structure for those of us that have rooftop power. But even though at only $5, because that's what Arizona passed, the utility in Arizona went after a $50 a month surcharge. Their Public Service Commission granted a $5 a month surcharge, and that $5 a month resulted in a 40% drop in new installations the next year. We have to be doing the opposite. Rather than discouraging, we need to be encouraging the use of solar.
Yeah, so you have a number of solar panels on your home. You also drive an electric car.
I have 37 solar panels.
Yeah, so you're more than, I guess, offsetting your power use.
Exactly.
And putting more into the system than,
exactly.
Huh?
And being able to allow Rocky Mountain Power to use the power that I generate during the summer months, in the afternoons when air conditioning is prevalent, and many of us in Park City don't have air conditioning, we are feeding that electricity into the grid, and Rocky Mountain Power gets to use that. So they get the benefit of that. When we pull it out later on in the winter, is at the low period of time, and there's a benefit for all of us to encourage rooftop solar.
So what are you asking folks to do? I mean, to show up at that October 8th hearing? Are you working? Is that what your goal is here?
Yes. First of all, public comment, any public comment that can come from individuals and or from the government to Public Service Commission in advance of the hearing. The hearing is, as I mentioned, at 5 p.m. on the 8th of October at the Heber Wells Building. We're going to have a rally right ahead of that at 4 p.m. This is 150 East, 300 South. I'm part of an organization called UCARE, Utah Citizens Advocating Renewable Energy, website UCARE.com. www.us.org for more information.
All right. Now, you also showed up at the city council meeting recently. You're working with the Utah Sierra Club as well?
That's correct. Working with Sierra Club, with Heal Utah, with Utah Clean Energy, it's a number of organizations that are involved in this effort, trying to move into the right direction. Because at the end of the day, Leslie, it doesn't matter whether you live in Park City or Fort Collins or Raleigh or Florence, Italy. This is one planet. We're in this together, and we need to work together to preserve the planet. We don't want to wait till Florida's underwater. We need to make some changes, and we need to make them right now.
Okay. Hey, David, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's Park City resident David Bennett. News time now, 8:59.
Morning news and the local news hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.